This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, and it's Friday, which for us means Week in Review, starting with the race for governor. You know, the person who oversees the government of Massachusetts? Incumbent Governor Charlie Baker met his challenger Jay Gonzalez for a first debate this week at Channel 4, where Baker pushed back against the charge that he's a status quo leader.
If I was a status quo governor, there'd still be thousands of homeless families living in hotels and motels in Massachusetts. There aren't. If I was a status quo governor, we wouldn't have a huge offshore wind and hydro program going on to replace a third of our fossil fuels with clean, renewable energy.
And Gonzalez kept repeating his response, that's just not enough.
It's not nearly enough. That's not an ambitious agenda. There's so much more we need to do to make a difference for working families in this state. And our transportation system is the thing I hear the most about everywhere I go. I will provide the bold leadership we need to fix it.
Joining us this week to talk about the contest and lots of other things Massachusetts is Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe and someone who has in the past saved me from making embarrassing errors in my own Globe pieces. How are you doing, Shira?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's great to see you here.
It's great to be sitting here with you. Also with us is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, great to have you too.
Good to be here.
Hope you don't feel outnumbered by the Globies at the table.
No, I'm sure. Happy to be here with everyone.
Okay, so the short version is, at least of the debate, Baker presents himself as an effective administrator, someone who's improved the T, improved programs for the homeless, held the line on taxes. Gonzalez pushed for big programs, big spending, and attacked the governor for thinking too small. Shira, what'd you take away from the debate?
Well, the takeaway for me and, you know, the 10 other people who watched it during the Red Sox game, I thought it was a really civil and engaging debate. It was actually a nice reminder of what maybe democracy should look like. Often when incumbents are 20 points ahead, maybe more in the polls, they'll only debate their opponent once. And I'm certainly not saying that's a good thing, but that's a strategy some incumbents employ. And in this case, Charlie Baker signed up for three debates. And the debate, the most recent one with him and Jay Gonzalez, was a nice civil discourse. It was like, oh, a nice reminder of what politics is sort of supposed to be like in normal times.
If only the Sox weren't playing and people knew about that. Michael, what'd you think?
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I thought, one little interesting wrinkle, it was shown on C-SPAN, and I was thinking, not to be all sort of Pollyanna-ish or gauzy about Massachusetts, but I thought it really showed, as Shira was saying, it showed the state well to the country in the sense that it was very substantive. I mean, I think the problem, I think like a lot of people, I thought they both acquitted themselves well. I'd kind of call it a draw. I think the problem for Jay Gonzalez is we've got less than a month to go. And at this point, if you think of it like kind of a 100-yard dash, you know, Charlie Baker starts on the 40-yard line. Mm-hmm. And that's
so
the problem for Gonzalez.
So a draw wasn't good enough for Gonzalez.
Yeah, I mean, a draw means he's still behind. So, you know, there was no big, apologies for the baseball sort of references. There was no big home run, you know, by anyone. Or a big, stumble coming around third. I don't know. I'm running out of baseball
references. I guess
baseball's
just on everybody's mind this time of year.
And so in that way, I thought, again, I think the Baker people have to probably be pretty happy with it.
Well, there was another line of attack that Gonzalez tried. That's the Jeff Diehl factor, right? Yeah. Diehl's the controversial former co-chair of Trump's 2016 campaign in Massachusetts, and he's the Republican candidate running against Elizabeth Warren for Senate. Here's Gonzalez.
By backing Jeff Diehl, Governor Baker is supporting an anti-choice agenda as well as an anti-LGBTQ, pro-NRA agenda. And I'm curious, Governor, why you have supported Jeff Diehl.
Now, Baker has a technical response that he committed to supporting the full Republican slate before he knew that Diehl would be the nominee.
Although he usually just calls it the ticket. He doesn't
call
it the Republican ticket.
The ticket.
Don't say that word.
Exactly, right?
Well, and then so that's the technical response. There's also the substantive response that he has openly opposed much of the Trump agenda.
My views on Donald Trump are quite well known. I didn't vote for him, and I've made quite clear my view on what I think about many of his positions and many of his policies. And he's not running. I'm running for governor, not Jeff Diehl.
So, Shira, is this a line of attack that can work for Gonzalez?
It's a tough sell for a lot of Massachusetts voters. We polled with Suffolk University a couple of weeks ago about this very matter, how much Baker as a Republican can be tied to technically the leader of his party, Donald Trump. And 60%, actually just over 60% of respondents in our survey viewed Baker as anti-Trump. as a candidate, which is so interesting, I think, especially even in Massachusetts, even for a Republican in Massachusetts. I thought it was it's notable. So it's a tough attack, but for Gonzalez, it may be one of the only things that is shown that can move the needle on it.
But it is interesting. Baker gets to keep that R next to his name, and yet people view him as anti-Trump. Michael, how does he pull this off?
I mean, I think there's still a sense. I mean, governors are really sort of out of the fray of the Washington fights. And when there have been fights there, as you're saying, I mean, you know, he was on the other side from the Republicans on the Affordable Care Act and other big issues. So I think people just are kind of giving him a little bit of a pass on the deal thing. I mean, you know, I suppose he could be really mavericky and say he's going to, you know, stay neutral in that race. But that's not really Charlie Baker's style. And so, you know, he kind of, you know, very quietly says, I'm with the ticket. I don't think you're going to see him make appearances with Deal. You know, he's hoping that that's sort of the end of it. And I don't think voters are really, he doesn't seem like he's going to pay a big price for that.
Well, you were going to say something, Cher.
If I can say, part of it, I think, is a history in Massachusetts of electing Republican governors who are maybe a little more mild-mannered, right? It draws such a contrast to Trump, Trump's being bombastic, especially during debates. So I think Massachusetts voters, in a way, are sort of used to this, attuned to this. And the other thing that's so striking, too, it's like whenever Baker gets on a stage or at a press conference or behind a podium, you're just reminded purely in his demeanor how different he is from the president. And I think a lot of Massachusetts voters see that and makes it a difficult sell. That said, Trump is the Massachusetts is the state that gives Trump the lowest marks out of every other state, except for the District of Columbia.
Presumably it hurts him with Trump voters. Does that matter? I mean, there were a million of them in the state. Does that make any difference at this stage, or with the primaries over, who cares? Michael?
I think it makes a little bit of a difference. And I think that, you know, I mean, Baker threw a little red meat to the base at the state party convention way back in the summer, if people can even remember that. So I think he's, you know, he's a little bit nervous about going too far and alienating those folks who are obviously not going to go to Gonzalez, but they could stay home.
35% of Republican primary voters chose Scott Lively. Right.
Right.
There's an element of that there in the party.
It's a non-trivial number. I mean,
it is not trivial. Yeah. And I'm betting we did not survey them. I don't know for sure. But a lot of Republicans viewed that as an anti-Baker vote. This is mostly anecdotal, right? But it viewed it as more of an anti-Baker vote than even a pro-Lively vote.
But do they just kind of send him a message with that and then reluctantly trudge in and vote for him? Or do they do something more and, you know, and blanket? That's the worry, I guess, that they do have.
Well, imagine that instead of political journalists, your political advisors. What would you tell? There's a reason we're not, right? There are other people who have the skill. But if we were, what would you tell Gonzalez? Is there anything he can do to gain traction in this race? Shira, you first.
Oh, I feel like I cannot answer that in my day job. I don't know. It is a tough race, right? This is an age in 2018, in the wake of the polling fiascos of 2016, you never want to trust polls anymore, right? You're inclined to always look at them so skeptically.
Not just 2016. We had the issue with Ayanna Pressley. That poll was a little bit out of date, and it really underestimated her chances.
It did. So it's very, I accept that it's really difficult to survey. And so there are trends out there and movements out there that we are just not seeing from where we sit all the time. I completely accept that. That said, we're talking about the Real Clear Politics average of 35-point spread. It's a tough race, but, you know, there's a million analogies, and we've been proven wrong so many times in the last couple of years.
Michael?
I mean, I don't, you know, it'd be hard to advise him now what to do. I mean, one thing I've noticed is he hasn't spent a lot of time sort of bashing, you know, the Beacon Hill establishment, which, you know, at times that's been one approach that people have taken to these statewide races. I mean, we know they're going to have to go in there and work with those. In fact, he's almost been the opposite. He's kind of suggested that, you know, his former boss, Deval Patrick, didn't really know how to get things done on Beacon Hill. So Gonzalez is trying a different tack, saying, I understand how things work there. So that's appealing, but it takes away from him that line of attack to say, you know, I'm going to sort of deal with the mess up there and the legislature, which, you know, as an institution polls very poorly. It's sort of the same with, you know, Congress. People like their own representative, but, you know, but as a whole, it's a pretty easy thing to sort of take target practice at.
Well, okay, let's shift gears a bit and talk about climate change. Okay, shift gears a lot and talk about climate change, but really what climate change means for Greater Boston, because the global news is bleak. The UN released a major report this week saying that the world needs to radically change its energy system within 10 years or risk ecological and social disaster. We're talking food shortages, wildfires, the die-off of coral reefs within the next 15 years, 10, 15 years. Here's Jim Ski, co-chair of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
The pledges that governments have made over the last 3 years are not enough to keep warming below 1.5 degrees C, even with ambitious and very challenging efforts after 2030.
Translation, it's bad and it's not getting any better. And that includes the potential of flooded streets in downtown. Michael, what's your read on how the city, the state is handling climate change?
I mean, I think most people give Boston a pretty good grade. I think that we've been, I don't know, ahead of the curve. I know there's been also, it's remarked that we've kind of dodged the bullet so far, and we haven't, you know, seen sort of one of these climate related catastrophes yet, but we're probably due for it. You know, to do the sort of sweeping kind of preparation is just also like multiple billions of dollars proposition. So I think for any region that's sort of a, you know, there's a big gulp that comes with how you're going to take that on. On the other hand, there's some stuff that we can be more proactive on. I thought there was actually a pretty good op-ed that ran in the Globe recently by the dean of the McCormick School at UMass Boston and someone who runs an entity there called the Sustainable Solutions Lab, Rebecca Hurst. And they said one thing that we could do at least is sort of take a more regional approach so that, you know, in the same way that we did when we established the MWRA or that we've dealt with our electrical grid. That we need sort of a regional approach since the floods and the effects are not going to respect municipal boundaries. So that's one kind of process approach. But
yeah, and there are local leaders saying that Boston needs to take dramatic steps, regional or otherwise, like John Cleveland. He's executive director of the Boston Green Ribbon Commission.
We have to decarbonize the grid. We have to electrify almost everything, including our heating, cooling, and transportation. And we have to dramatically reduce the demand for energy and individual cars.
Just that. No, nothing more than that.
Yeah, that's nothing. Just a few things tick off the to-do list.
Yeah,
you know?
Shira, what's your take on how the city, the state is handling this challenge?
Well, I think the city and the state, they're sort of different cases, but I think they're looking at it. I mean, this climate report says that no one is doing this nearly fast enough, right? What's striking to me is how much of the blame a lot of the study put on coal, which for the most part is not an industry that the state is known for, but yet we in Boston are the ones who are going to feel the effects of continued use of coal throughout the country, especially the middle of the country. So I think it's an interesting problem. There's been talk, obviously, about this $11 billion seawall in the harbor, and eventually they decided that was not a, well, not, they've come to terms that it's probably not the best idea, that they want to look at these sort of smaller projects, but we're going to feel it sooner rather than later. And in many ways, this could be one part of Marty Walsh's legacy as mayor of Boston the next couple years, right? Is how he sets up the city during this pivotal time to be resilient against the forces of climate change and most notably flooding. I mean, last January, if that's a preview, remember, of the storms and the flooding in the harbor, that's a preview of things to come. It's scary.
Yeah. On the environment, Baker said last night that he's failed to meet his own pledge of 1% spending on environmental issues. He said it's only been about 0.5%. That's of total budgetary spending. This is how he put it.
I apologize for not delivering on my promise. The only caveat I could offer on that, well, I'm not even going to go there. I apologize for not delivering on my commitment. I don't like not delivering on commitments that I make.
That was at the Museum of Science Forum last night, where he just acknowledged he hasn't delivered on this commitment. He's sorry about that. Gonzalez has made a similar pledge.
By not later than the end of my first term, we will dedicate 1% of the state budget to environmental agencies. And we will make meaningful progress each year until we get there. That is a commitment of mine you can count on.
So I guess I'm circling back to the governor's race in a way here, but that's part of the question.
We don't mind.
Is this something that's at stake in the governor's race, Massachusetts's preparation for climate change? Cheerio.
I think it's an issue that Democrats and liberals like to talk about. I think you are in Massachusetts compared to a whole lot of other states. You find a lot of environmentally focused voters. Is the question of will it be the decision maker for the 55% or so of independent voters out there? I don't know. I don't necessarily see that in these times, but it's still a major issue, and it's going to just continue to be, I think, a growing issue. Mm.
How's this for a segue? You can grade me. From the destruction of the planet to the destruction of state records.
Oh, yes? Very good.
All right.
10 out of 10.
Let's talk about ongoing scandals at the Massachusetts State Police. 2018 has been a year of state police scandals, from fake overtime claims to charges of political favoritism. Two former state police commanders were in court today denying the charges of overtime abuse. Yesterday, another trooper pleaded guilty to embezzlement in federal court. And WBUR broke the story this week that the agency sought permission to destroy documents, some dating back decades, that could be essential to future investigations. Michael, what'd you make of the most recent twist in this story?
What I made of it was that was a horrible look for the state police. And there's just no other way to look at it. There was, I guess, technically the request to destroy records, complied with all the regulations around how old they have to be and so forth. But, you'd have to be crazy to not realize there's a broader context at the moment with these investigations. And, the governor came out and said this shouldn't be done. They shouldn't be seeking these. But I think there's still a lot of question about, there were three different requests submitted by three different people. What prompted those requests? Was there anyone higher up on the food chain that had to approve them or that maybe initiated the requests? And is there any accountability now for how that happened? We need kind of a deconstruction of how this came about. It's not enough that we just know that this records board denied the requests and cited the ongoing investigations. I think there is still, it doesn't smell good.
Well, you mentioned the governor's comment on it. Let's listen to that.
What they did was completely consistent with standard operating procedure. They shouldn't be destroying payroll records. They shouldn't be operating under standard operating procedure at this point in time, given everything else that's going on with respect to the state police and payroll.
And since I can't get away from the governor's race, let's also listen to Jay Gonzalez's response, which was sharper.
The colonel should be fired. The secretary of public safety should be fired. The governor should appoint someone to lead his state police who's going to root out corruption, someone from the outside who's got credibility.
Shira, is this the governor's fault, or should we think more broadly about what's going on behind this, lack of oversight, cultural problems at the state police? How do you see responsibility?
I think in terms of voters, if there's one major issue where the candidates are split on in terms of recent news, it's this one, right? Because Charlie Baker has clearly stood by Colonel Carrie Gilpin throughout this. Jay Gonzalez has said she and many others need to go, right? This is certainly a difference.
That's a very concrete distinction.
Absolutely, between the two candidates. And I think it's an issue and an opportunity actually for Jay Gonzalez to get a lot of traction. Charlie Baker has cited in several of his responses about the ongoings in this incident that it's happened prior to his time. It was established before his time. And our editorial board noted this morning that they don't think that's good enough anymore. He's been in office for 3.5 years.
Yeah, we have the quote, actually. I have in front of me from the Globe editorial. Baker's the boss now, which means the buck stops with him. Under this governor, the state police clearly thought they could get away with blatantly inappropriate behavior. How extremely disappointing. You go on. I mean,
that's obviously our editorial board, which is separate from our news department. But the governor certainly has an issue with this here. And it's a political issue as much as it is a state issue.
Michael, do you have a sense for where this should start if the problem is going to get fixed?
It's hard to know whether Gilpin, Gonzalez says, the fish rots from the head down, even though she's newly appointed. He thinks there needs to be a change in leadership and someone brought in from the outside. So I'm not sure about that. The other thing that I would just note is that, when there are problems that come up anywhere in government, that's not good. But there is a particularly corrosive effect of corruption within law enforcement. And that's something that, I think you can't emphasize enough. There's been a lot of talk about
corrosive in what way?
Just in terms of public confidence in government. These are the people who enforce norms of behavior on all of us. And yet, if this is what's going on within the department, I mean, it just undermines, I don't want to sound too dramatic, it undermines the whole premise of the rule of law, but at some point it does.
I agree. These are the people who give you speeding tickets, right? These are the people who a lot of citizens have the most interaction with, right? Or hopefully not have the most interaction with, I should say.
But it is one aspect where you touch upon government in your daily life. They're following you on the highway if you're speeding, things like that.
Right. You see cops at intersections. You see it all. So I think it really has a pervasive effect in the way other issues don't.
And do you think it is improving? Do you think the charges brought are making a difference? Or do you think, no, in fact, we're just at the beginning of fixing this? Michael?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much more there is to be discovered. I mean, I think we're in that phase where it doesn't look good, but it's kind of the cleansing process that you have to go through to get to a better place on the other end of it all. So, you know, hopefully, you know, things are getting better by the sort of sunlight being, flashing on what's going on there and the kind of cases and investigations running their course.
All right. Well, maybe let's end with some lighter news than the corruption that corrosively undermines faith in government. Hubbubs. Everybody loves a hubbub. The brief stories or events that didn't get a lot of general attention but caught your attention this week. Shira, what jumped out at you?
Well, this got some attention, but I thought it was such a fun idea that I wanted to bring it up. British developer Scape has plans to build $1 billion in privately run dorms, 5 buildings, up to 3,000 beds for essentially college students. And they wouldn't be exclusive to a single school. They'd be these towers where students, mostly upperclassmen, they say gravitate towards these, would be housed in one building. And it just sounded like a fun community. That could be here in the city and alleviate not only problems for college students who unfortunately because of budget constraints end up living in conditions that are not always up to par, and also for the city, which is having a housing crunch. Right, it opens up has the potential to open up some housing for the workforce instead of the student force. My one thought is, the story noted that this company looked for 18 months for a spot in America to open up their first dorm. I'm like, it took you 18 months to find Boston? What?
We're here.
We have so many college students.
No, but they're not the only ones struggling to get permission to build buildings in America.
This is true.
Michael, your hubbub?
So mine is something that has actually been building for a while, but actually will kind of come with a bang tomorrow. So we're looking ahead a little bit, and that is tomorrow, Artists for Humanity, which is was founded as a small nonprofit back in 1991, will celebrate the opening of a new addition to its Epicenter, which is its main building in South Boston. And this will double to more than 500 the number of Boston teens that it serves through what is a really cool model of paid mentoring of young people in art and design fields. And so it's an amazing program. It's great that they're going to be able to serve so many more kids. As their name says, Artists for Humanity, more art, more humanity. What could be wrong with that?
Who's opposed to that?
Exactly.
All right, my hubbub then. The Boston Dynamics robot. I don't know if you've seen these videos. If you haven't, you must. For a couple of years, this company, this local company, Boston Dynamics, has been training this Android robot that looks like a person, that has two legs, two arms, torso. And the early videos are kind of cute. They teach it to walk a little bit, and it stumbles. Well, this week they released a video in which it does parkour. Which is not like training a little child to walk. It's like watching your future robot overlords teach you how human bodies could move if they were only powered by machines. It was fascinating, harrowing glimpse into our future.
Maybe they'll save us from climate change.
Well, that's something. Michael Jonas is executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thanks, Michael, for coming in.
Thank you.
And Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll check in today with Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek down at City Hall Plaza for Hub Week. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston.